Welcome to The Swing,
Canada's political analysis for a global audience.
I'm Yaroslav Varan.
I'm Heather Bakken.
Today we're going to talk about trade drama, the Middle East, and big, beautiful ballots. Yaroslav, everybody was waiting for August 1st. That was the trade deadline between Canada and the U.S. It came and went with no trade deal. Did the sky fall?
Well, no, the sky didn't actually fall. A lot of people were focused on that August 1st deadline because that was the date on which Donald Trump imposed a 35% across-the-board tariff on imports from Canada. However, as we discussed last week, what Canadian exporters have been doing for the last number of months is frantically filling out the paperwork to become CUSMA compliant. Previously, a whole bunch of exporters didn't even bother registering their exports through the Canada-US-Mexico Free Trade Agreement because there's an extra compliance burden without much incremental benefit in, you know, filling out all this additional paperwork. But having a large looming tariff really whipped them into shape, and a whole bunch of exporters got compliant, and now the vast majority of Canada's exports to the United States are compliant under CUSMA. So yeah, the sky didn't fall because exporters took on the protection of the free trade agreement that they previously weren't bothering to use.
And we're also diversifying our export markets now, aren't we, in response to the threat of tariffs from the U.S.?
Well, yeah, that's something that all exporters in Canada are doing and have been doing for several months. They're looking for new markets to offset the volatility of the U.S. export market. It's, you know, it's called hedging your bets, I suppose. But the benefit now for Canada's negotiating team is, rather than needing to protect an entire national economy, they can now focus on several areas, several commodities that are still under tariff and under significant tariffs. Steel, aluminum, and copper are now under 50% tariff, and these are devastating levels. And also softwood lumber is under tariffs. It's a little bit of a variable rate depending on the producer, but they're under high tariffs, roughly around 35 to, in some cases, 40, 42%. And these are significant challenges, but it's a lot easier for a negotiating team to focus on four sectors rather than a whole economy.
Is it fair to say we're still trying to find our footing?
Well, sure, because, you know, we just had some recent data come out from StatsCan on our trade deficits, but it is a bit of an illusory picture and a moving target because businesses on both sides of the border knew that this trade war was on and only going to get worse. So they stockpiled on inventories under a previous lower tariff regime, battening the hatches. You know, it's kind of like stocking up your larder, your pantry, knowing that there are lean times ahead. So those inventories are still being depleted on both sides of the border. So the full brunt of the trade war has not yet been felt by either economy. And that's probably when we're going to see increased political pressure on both sides of the border to try to make this go away, to try to come to some sort of a deal. We're still sort of sheltered artificially from the real impacts of the trade war.
That's a really good point. It reminds me of the run on toilet paper during the beginning of the pandemic. I think the good news for Canada is that the tariffs on copper.
Copper is a bit of a different picture from steel and aluminum. Yes, Canadian copper is now facing a 50% tariff, and that's a very high tariff. But copper is a little bit different in that Canada exports four times as much copper to the United States as the United States produces domestically. So what that means in the end is that for this particular commodity, Americans are still going to have to be importing Canadian copper just at a much higher price by their own doing. So they really just kind of shot themselves in the foot. But in the interest of long-term trade stability, this is still something that Canada's negotiating team is going to try to resolve.
Softwood lumber, you were talking about that. It was pretty interesting what you were saying about that industry.
Yeah, softwood lumber is a little bit of a different beast. It's not the same tariffs that apply to softwood. The softwood lumber, Canadian softwood, is under a combination of countervailing duties and anti-dumping duties, and they're imposed under a separate statute, the U.S. Tariff Act of 1930. And these are cyclical duties that are actually initiated by U.S. industry, not by cabinet. as is the case with the steel, aluminum, and copper tariffs. And this is something that rears its head about every 5 years or so when there's a new petition from U.S. lumber producers. And then that triggers an investigation over subsidy rates and dumping margins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then duties are imposed, after which Canada and the U.S. go into a series of negotiations and then negotiate them away. They come up with a reasonably temporary solution until the whole drama starts all over again about another 4 or 5 years later. So this is something that comes and goes. Whether it's part of a final deal, we'll see, or it may just continue to be a cyclical phenomenon in Canada-U.S. trade, as it has been for many, many years.
Okay, so the other big thing that happened since we last spoke was the Prime Minister's office issued a statement that Canada intends to recognize the state of Palestine at the United Nations General Assembly this September. What's the political impact of this decision, Yaroslav?
Well, it is a very significant diplomatic move by the government of Canada. And we recall that there was significant pressure from the president of France and then later the prime minister of the United Kingdom. France already declared that it will recognize a Palestinian state in September. And the UK said that it very well may if significant progress isn't made on the humanitarian picture in Palestine. So Canada took a slightly nuanced position from the other two, and it said it will indeed recognize a Palestinian state while still affirming the tragedy, the unilateral fault with the October 7th massacre, but also putting conditions on the recognition of a Palestinian state.
Well, this is a good point to remind our listeners that Canada was the first country to step up and condemn Hamas as a terrorist organization when they won their election in Gaza.
Yeah, and another important point is that it is, in fact, longstanding policy of the government of Canada that a two-state solution is the appropriate solution forward. So people who commend this policy will say, well, this is just acting on what was already Canadian foreign policy. The counter-argument, of course, is when are you doing it? This is the worst possible timing. And in the current context, you're actually rewarding terrorism. So it is a very complicated issue. There's also a potential trade implication. Donald Trump has explicitly criticized this foreign policy declaration by the government of Canada. He has not said that it will stop him from reaching a trade agreement with Canada, but there was at least an implicit signal that it's not going to make things a lot easier for Canada and the U.S. to reach a trade agreement in light of that declaration.
One of the things I will say, though, I'll credit the prime minister's with in terms of making this statement, is that there is, it's basically a very clear condemnation of Hamas as a terrorist organization. What's really fascinating to me is the entire Arab League has condemned Hamas. And to your earlier comment about the connection with Iran, a lot of the disinformation related to Hamas and Gaza originated in Farsi, which is the language spoken in Iran, not Gaza. Gazans speak Arabic. But okay, we'll see what happens on the way forward and where things stand next month. Let's move on to a big issue in Canada that might help our audience understand our political and electoral system. Elections Canada has announced that it will use an adapted ballot for the by-election in Battle River Crowfoot. Can you explain what this means, please, Yaroslav?
Sure, yes. This is, of course, the by-election in which Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre is running in order to regain a seat in the House of Commons. The Long Ballot Committee, this is a protest movement, has decided to assist a whole bunch of candidates to put their names forward on this ballot. And unlike most by-elections where you might have 6, 7, maybe a dozen candidates on the ballot, we now have more than 200 names on the ballot. And again, a vast majority of these are linked to this protest movement and are really there just to cause trouble, not to genuinely be running for that seat.
Well, I just want to jump in here and say that previously the record was set in last June in the by-election in St. Paul's, Toronto, and they had 84 people on the ballot. So it's more than doubled.
Yeah, the same group was active in the St. Paul's by-election in Toronto last year, as well as the by-election in Montreal last year as well. So this is not something that just popped up out of nowhere. They've been around for some time. The whole point is to make a whole lot of noise and draw attention to what they say is the need for electoral reform in Canada. But it causes problems, because how does Elections Canada deal with a polling ballot with over 200 names on it? It's unwieldy. The thing would be about as long as a roll of toilet paper, and you've got to find your candidate in order to put your X on the ballot. So what they've decided to do is switch to a different model, where rather than finding the name and marking an X, you will be actually writing in the name of your preferred candidate. So they're going to have all the names on posters on your way in. You find your preferred candidate and you write it into the ballot. Now, for Mr. Poiliev, who I think we have to recognize as a front runner, it's not an ideal scenario, because I imagine a lot of people won't even know how to spell his name. But again, Elections Canada says that they're going to make allowances for that, and spelling mistakes will be accepted as a non-spoils ballot.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's good that they're doing that, because it is very important to franchise people. You can't really fault them for a spelling mistake.
Yeah, it also underscores the need for taking election security a little bit more seriously than we have done in the past. Not to suggest we haven't taken it seriously, but I think we've taken a lot for granted. If these kinds of protest movements are permitted to continue as they have been rolling out, we do open the door to additional and more egregious electoral disruption. As you know, Heather, I have led Canadian election observation missions abroad, and I've seen some related but worse things. For example, I've seen situations where opposing parties will try to block a front runner by recruiting numerous candidates with exactly the same name as that front runner, so that you end up having three or four or five people all with the same name on the ballot. And that sort of thing can cause genuine confusion in the minds of the voting public and genuine distortion of what would be organic democratic election results. So we need to take stock of this protest movement, how it's playing itself out, and are there things that we can do to rebalance, you know, the right of people to put their name on a ballot with the integrity and security of elections? Because we do not want to allow a situation as we've seen in other countries, where you can manipulate and interfere to an even greater degree using similar methods.
Well, that's a really good point, Yaroslav. There's a lot of mischief out in election time.
There's always mischief. Some mischief is greater than others, and some needs to be taken more seriously than others. This is sort of on the bubble between just being dirty tricks and something potentially more serious. But now is the time to take stock of this and figure out how we want our system to look going forward.
Okay. Well, I think it's a good place to leave it. We're going to be closing shop for 2 weeks up in Canada's far north, trying to get in the last bit of good weather before the House returns.
All right, Heather, thanks for the chat.
Have a good vacation.
Thank you. Talk soon.